Well, there's obviously a lot to say, and if I'd had chance to read these before, I might have been able to sort of link everything together, but I'm not going to. All I'm just going to do is just follow the pattern of other people and throw out a few questions to each person, and one or two observations, and perhaps we'll do this exactly the same. They can each answer whatever they think is worth answering, and then we'll throw it open to the cell. So to begin with Robert's a paper which particularly fascinated me because I'm also sort of working a bit on 68 and also have worked on the war. And I suppose I got three questions. I mean, one thing I was particularly struck by, which isn't a question, is when he was talking about Senik. It reminded me of this extraordinary, and I know that Robert admires it as much as I do, memoir which came out last year by year before by Virginie Linhart, called Le Jour où mon père s'est tué, where she talks about her father, Robert Linhart, who was a Maoist établi in 1970s. And she has this wonderful phrase about her father. I think it's so extraordinary. She says that for him and for, and she talks about several other Jews, she said, in 68, pour la première fois, ils ne sont plus des survivants, ils ont vécu. So it was not surviving, it was living. And that's an observation which, I thought it was, given that the example that Robert chose was not from one that Virginie Linhart talked about, and yet what he quoted was so similar. I've got really three questions for Robert. The first is there a kind of, what's very striking is that all his examples come from, all of them, I think, came from the Gauche Prolétarienne, none from the LCR, the Ligue Communiste Révolutionnaire, none from the Trotskyists, all from the Maoists. And I just wonder whether he's observed a different use of the resistance pass between the Maoists and the Trotskyists. I mean, at my seminar in London, Richard Wolin, who's just done this book about the Maoists in 68, he came and somebody asked him a good question, I thought. He said, what's Maoist about the French Maoists? And I thought that was actually a very brilliant question because they are very odd as Maoists. And I wonder whether they're moralists more than Maoists, it seems to me, the French Maoists. And I wonder whether Roberts has... And therefore, for them, the war is a great reliving of a moral experience, a transposition of the morality of the war into contemporary politics. Trotskyists are much more complicated and sort of manipulative. And I just wonder whether the Trotskyists had a different relation to that. That's the first question. The second was, I was very struck in Robert's presentation that he only offered two polarities when thinking about the war. One was either you thought about Gaullism, either they thought, what did they think about the Free French, or what did they think about the internal resistance? And then Robert always then said, the internal resistance, communists. Of course, there were many other internal resistances, and I was wondered whether there was any attempt actually to recuperate, to rediscover, as it were, because most of the French resistance was not communist. And what I find curious about that is, of course, that it should cause complications for the Maoists and the LCR, who were, of course, violently anti-PCF. They were gauchistes who hated the French Communist Party. So it could be that they were rediscovering a communist past against the Communist Party, or that they didn't have the wit or historical knowledge to realise that there were other possible possible resistances that they could use. But it may have just been it was the violence. But after all, much of the Maquis was not communist, and yet it seemed to be always the communists that came up in what Robert said. The final thing on what Robert said, it's very striking, and it sort of links also then going to what Sudhir was talking about. I mean, there's this extraordinary episode in June 1971 when Le Dantec and others go to Mont-Valérien, and they take a wreath to Mont-Valérien on the 18th of June 1971. Now, of course, Pompidou is president, so this is an anti-Pompidolian Gaullism, as it were. But nonetheless, what's interesting about it, what it makes me wonder is one of the reasons why, and something that Robert talked about at the end, French left, extreme left in the 1970s, didn't go into terrorism, drew back from the abyss. Is it something to do And it always seems to me that no one ever explains it, and that Robert didn't explain it either. He just said they suddenly saw what violence would do, and they stopped. But after all, the Italians didn't stop, and the Germans didn't stop. And I wonder whether the reason why the French did stop is something to do with their relationship to the war, and in fact to the fact that you can't be, that in a sense they weren't as angry with their parents as the Germans were and the Italians were. And so that in some sense the explanation for the non-basculement into terrorism is something to do with the relationship between the 70th generation and the war. On what Sudhir was talking about, I mean, I just love the idea. I loved his stuff about the streets. And I was thinking, is there an impasse de Gaulle? But I don't think there is. But sorry, that's just a purely facetious comment. There are one or two, the three comments I'd have on what sort of four comments. So question, they'll send me questions. First, I also saw that poll of Fondation Charles de Gaulle did in November, October last year. And actually, I was more interested I was very interested in the people with whom de Gaulle was being compared. And they were a most peculiar bunch. And I wonder whether they were being suggested to people, because they were Charlemagne, Louis XIV. But then at the curious ones at the bottom, Jaurès and Blum. And I thought, what are they doing there? So I always wonder about these polls, how suggested they are. But what I thought was most interesting about that poll was actually the fact that there was a question, do de Gaulle's ideas matter to us today? I can't remember how it went, something like that. And what was very striking there is there was a big majority that said no. At the same time as they said he was the greatest figure in the history of France. That was the first thing. Secondly, on Napoleon, I just wonder, I'm always struck, but you may be right and me wrong, about de Gaulle's ambivalence about Napoleon, that in La France et son armée, and also in much of his sort of table talk, or whatever you want to call it, he comes back again and again to the fact that Napoleon did not know when to stop, that he was an opportunist, that he was interested in a personal ambition, unlike de Gaulle, for that matter, who was, as it were, subsumed personal ambition into the state. And I've always been interested by the fact that it seems to me that if you take Churchill and de Gaulle, Churchill admired Napoleon much more than de Gaulle did. Churchill actually had a bust of Napoleon in Chartwell on his desk. But I may be wrong about that. Thirdly, Sarkozy and Napoleon. We've mentioned, which will bring us to the next thing. Now, Sarkozy and de Gaulle. I think Sarkozy's relation to de Gaulle is very interesting because what I'm struck by is how little, or how much less. I mean, everybody has to talk about de Gaulle, and even last year Sarkozy came to London. No one has done that before on the 18th of June. But what was striking is Sarkozy goes to Glières. He's made Glières his own personal pilgrimage. That's to say, not a Gaullist site. When he goes to Mont-Valérien, he goes on the 18th of June, but he also went in February 2007, I think. And who did he talk about? Not de Gaulle, but communist resistors and Catholics and so on. So it's almost as if Sarkozy is trying to, as it were, find a space outside de Gaulle, which doesn't mean that he doesn't obviously have to talk about de Gaulle, because everyone does. And then the final thing about was your thing about de Gaulle as non-military hero, which I thought was really interesting. I think there's a lot I'd never thought about that, and I think it's very fascinating. But what I've always thought interesting about de Gaulle is that if there's one consistency in de Gaulle's, well, there are many consistencies in de Gaulle thought, but one thing that runs throughout de Gaulle's writing and thinking from the very first book he ever wrote, which is Discours chez l'ennemi, is this idea of the importance of the civil over the military. I mean, it's a very strong thing with him, and I just wonder whether you'd have any comment about that. There is one other very important point. Sorry, a question I must ask you about this. What seems to me interesting is that the cult of de Gaulle has grown in inverse proportion to the collapse of the Gaullist view of history. That is to say, Chirac in 1990, when Chirac made his famous speech in 1995, saying that La France a commis un acte irréparable, which many Gaullists were very against because they thought that in some sense this was destroying a Gaullist mythology, that, in a sense, no one now believes the Gaullist myth of history. And it's almost as if, as you don't believe in the Gaullist myth of history, in other words, you don't believe that France was résistante, you have to believe that someone was résistante, and therefore you actually need to believe more in de Gaulle than you did before. Then finally, going on to this, going on to the final, what was, first, we were back in a kind of way with a sort of exception française, with, well, not an exception, but a middle français, sort of français, you know, middle path. I just wonder whether actually France in this is very different from most other European, I wondered whether there was a Catholic-Protestant thing going on here, partly. And it struck me there's never been, by the way, it's interesting that the two failed presidential candidates you talked about, Jospin and Rocard, were both Protestants. There's only ever been one Protestant president of the Republic, and that's Gaston Dumergue, who's a somewhat forgettable figure. But I wondered whether it was something, whether there's something to do with Protestantism, Catholicism, as an explanation there. But also, I was just wondering, is France so different, say, from Britain on this? I mean, when you talked about the cars, you know, that we all remember in this country, you know, Cameron wanting to show that he was so sort of man of the people, being on a bicycle, but actually the car was following behind. So I just wonder whether there's anything specifically French about this, and therefore whether we need to invoke these long cultural Versailles, Versailles versus the revolution and so on. But equally, I thought your thing about the balance between humility and grandeur, you didn't quite use it. Curiously does link with something that Sudhir almost said about de Gaulle, that the curious mixture. I mean, de Gaulle, as he says, is not humble in any normal sense of the term, but there's a sense in which there is a kind of humility about de Gaulle and an austerity about de Gaulle, which is interesting. And then just finally, I'm just reading, and also it did strike me that the deployment of the word republic by these mayors that you talked about shows what Christophe was saying, how the word republic means absolutely nothing at all today. You can use it to mean anything you want. And then the final point I would make was, I'm just reading, it's in my bag, and I'll find it if anyone wants to cry. I'm reading Annette Viviorca's biography of Maurice Torres and Jeannette Vermeche. And there's a wonderful passage in that book about Torres's car. And since you talked about, and it's all about, he had a special car. He had only one of 10, what's that firm called? Delahaye, yes. And he had a particularly special one, which was auctioned off at Christie's about 3 or 4 years ago, because it was one of only, you know, a particularly remarkable Blandet version. So I thought that your stuff, you know, André Siegfried, when he talked about, the Tableau Politique de la France, he never thought about deep structures in ownership of cars. And I thought that Alpes-Maritimes and cars was very fascinating. So those are my points. And I think if we could just let anybody reply to anything they think is worth replying to, and then we'll open it to the floor.
Okay, Robert. And you need
well,
this.
Wonderful, wonderful analysis, Julian. It's a bit like being in a Viva. And it's, I think Richard Cobb and Douglas Johnson were a lot easier on me. Trots. I think I come clean, and most of the, I mean, I interviewed a lot of Maoists and few Trots. I didn't actually like the Trots very much. But in terms of what they referred to, I think the Trots were much more interested in the Bolshevik Revolution, if not the Paris Commune. And one of the non-attractive Trots I interviewed was Benjamin Storer, and he just said, it's all in the book. And he had written this book called La Dernière Génération d'Octobre, which is how he saw his version of 68. In terms of internal external resistance, that was a very good point. I mean, in terms of subdivisions, I mean, the people I quote are not just... There is this cult among some resistors of Jewish origin, of the Jewish communist resistance and not just the communist resistance. But if you take the case of Burnier, who's kind of... He's not a Maoist. He's in the communist students, but then he moves out, and he's one of the Italians, as they call them. And a lot of the Italians, Senec's another one, they kind of move, they become very anti-communist within fairly short order. His hero, as I said, was Emmanuel d'Asti de la Vigerie, who, of course, is not a communist. And the last point about why they didn't go down the road to violence, I mean, a very interesting point about whether there is a kind of reconciliation with the parents. I mean, Le Dantec has been in prison for several months. He then comes out of prison, and it's at that point that he's cultivated by Clavel and vice versa. And it's at the point at which the GP sprouts a kind of, they call a democratic arm, or open democratic arm called the Secours Rouge, which involves many more people, and it's not involved in sort of clandestine activity. And it's part of that movement out of violence into a more open democratic strategy, you could call it a kind of reconciliation with the parents or parental figures. And I think that's, you do, in a lot of these people's narratives, there is a kind of reconciliation with fathers and indeed mothers. For example, the case of Dominique Grange, who does keep going with the violence, she says she had a reconciliation with her father, who, because she was locked up in prison at one point about 1970, and she said, well, at that point, my father said, well, now I now sympathise with you, even though you're a Maoist, because, you know, when the doors of the Stalag, you know, closed shut on me in Germany, I realised, and I did have a sympathy for anyone who was in prison. So I think there's something to follow. But my last reference would be to François Furet, because actually, when I interviewed Olivier Rollin, he pointedly got off his bookshelf a book edited by François Furet, and it's called Démocratie et Terrorisme. And in that book, there's an article by a man called Antoine Lillier, who doesn't actually exist. Antoine Lillier is Olivier Rollin. And there's a long essay on why we, the Maoists, didn't go down the road of terrorism. And he gives a number of reasons. First of all, he says we were all at the École Normale Supérieure, so we were all philosophers, and basically we didn't do violence. There's also an argument about how in France the Maoists listened to the workers. I mean, their great idea was a sort of false humility in front of the workers. And therefore, if the workers weren't going to go for revolution, they weren't going to go for revolution. Whereas they said the Germans went down the road of terrorism because the German activists knew the workers were never with them in the first place, so they just had to do it themselves. But I think the argument about, you know, end of violence, reconciliation with parents is something I can certainly think more about.
Just say something very quickly. Thank you for your comments, Julian. On the ambivalence with regard to Napoleon, I think, yes, there is ambivalence, of course. In a way, I think the best way to kind of read de Gaulle's reading of Napoleon is to do it through Chateaubriand. Chateaubriand is de Gaulle's favorite 19th century memorialist. De Gaulle admits that his kind of aesthetic model when he's writing his Mémoires de Guerre are the Mémoires d'Outre-Tombe. And I think pretty much everything that de Gaulle sees of Napoleon, he sees through Chateaubriand's eyes. And Chateaubriand has a complex view of Napoleon. But it's a view which becomes warmer as Chateaubriand gets older. And I think, in a nutshell, that is what happens to de Gaulle, too. Although, if you read his early speeches, when he's a lecturer in history at Saint-Cyr, and he's talking about Napoleon as a kind of military strategist, if you read the first volume of of de Gaulle's works, you find a lot of those lectures in there. And there are no qualifications. I mean, Napoleon is just presented as a military genius. Later on, the qualifications are political. But I think the approach becomes... De Gaulle becomes more and more fascinated by Napoleon as he senses, as he takes the measure of the kind of mythological dimension of Napoleon. So that would be my quick answer. But going through Chateaubriand, I think, is the most helpful thing to do there. On the non-military heroism, yeah, I mean, I think thinking of it as a civilian form of heroism, yes. In a way, there too, I didn't have time to talk about it in detail. I think the answer goes through understanding this very curious institution that the Free French created and which I think explains, really, the Gaullian conception of heroism. And this is the Compagnons de la Libération. That is the supreme order of the Free French. I was about to say the supreme order of the resistance, but that would be controversial because, of course, different groups have different views of what the supreme order is. As far as de Gaulle is concerned, there is only one knighthood, as it were, of the resistance, and it's the Compagnons. There are only 1,063 of them. The order is closed at the liberation, so you don't create any more of them. The complexity is that some of them are military and some of them are civilian. a majority are military. So that would be a counter to your view that it is a civilian order. But the values are Republican. So that comes back to the notion of it being civilian. But I think that's where I would, that's how I would try and think through further this question. As I say, I haven't really thought through it completely yet, but I think it's something interesting. Finally, on I'll take your first and your last point together, the thing about Gorlias' ideas no longer mattering, which came out from the opinion poll, and the sense of the Gorlias' vision of history disappearing. Yes, I think that's absolutely right, but I think it's a measure of the plasticity of the Gorlian myth, because what has happened... I mean, if I had to say it very schematically, the crucial separation that takes place in terms of the history of the Gorlian myth is what happens in 1970 when de Gaulle dies. Because what you then have is a separation of de Gaulle, the man, the historical figure, from de Gaulle, the party leader and the creator of institutions. The Gaullist party continues a rather undistinguished life for the next 35 years. But whatever happens to the Gaullist party has no bearing on the Gaullist myth, right? It's as the Marxists used to say, relatively autonomous. What happens to de Gaulle, what happens to the institutions of the Fifth Republic have relatively little incidence on the myth. The myth takes on a much more individual character as you move into the later years of the 20th century. And I would say today, what is the most important characteristic of the Gaullist myth are the individual, personal, almost moral qualities that are attached to him as a person. He embodies disinterestedness, if that's a word, virtue. He's the opposite of bling bling. I mean, that's why the contrast is so staggering between him and Sarkozy. And he embodies this thing that the French are still very much attached to, which he created, even though they're no longer wedded to the Gaullian vision of history, which is this idea that, which is this notion of a kind of voluntarist kind of politics, right? The denial of fatality. You know, we're not the prisoners of globalization or of these great forces that try to say nothing is possible anymore. We can still do things. That's the part of the myth that I think is still very much alive, and it expresses the French and indeed, you know, the frustration that exists all over Europe at the fact that we keep being told we can't do these sorts of, we can't do what we want anymore. We're trapped, right? De Gaulle stood for the opposite of that view.
Very quickly on Catholicism and Protestantism. Definitely, yeah. It's an important variable when you compare politics in Europe. Although it would be important to consider several types of Protestantism. I mean, England is not Geneva, you know, things like that. But yes, definitely. It's not only the question of humility versus certain ostentation. Though I found that, I mean, I've seen quite a few examples in Scandinavia of people who had to resign for what would be considered in France peccadillos, like the story of a bottle of wine, and after you have the press talking about it, and after a few days, I mean, the person has to resign, and this is the end of the political career. But it has also to do with the private and public dimension. I think, as we all know, in the Catholic code, you have a strict separation between the private and the public, and it's quite possible to have a certain private image, and it will not necessarily affect your public image. To come back to Rocard, with a counterexample, the Protestant example, we all know that Rocard divorced 3 times, and this would not affect, I think, his political image in a country such as France. Whereas in the Nordic countries, it's very hard to make a separation between your private life and your public life. Say, for instance, if you are caught cheating your wife, people will say we can't trust him, we can trust him as a politician, because there is hardly any separation between the private and the public life. About the comparison between England or the UK and France, it's a very complex question. The more I think, the more I read about British elites, and because it's related to aristocracy. Because obviously in the two cases you have an aristocratic past, but quite different, because there is the French Revolution on the one side, and on the other hand you have an aristocracy which remained at the top until at least the First World War, at least as a social model. If you read Proust, it seems that it was also the same thing in France, but this is really debatable. I mean, if we read Zeldin or other interpretation, it seems that the bourgeoisie was already hegemonic much earlier, and that the aristocrats were on the wane. I mean, anyway, there are controversies about historians regarding this. I still believe that, maybe it wouldn't be so different here, although you have some Labour Party people who really, I mean, much before Tony Blair, we used the card, which was very much on the anti-ostentatious, you know, cultivating a Labour class accent, for instance, or something like that, very much against the upper class accent, and we know how much accent is important in this country, it works in. I mean, I wouldn't say that France is really an exception here. There are other countries where you have this tension for different reasons. I mean, in the USA you also have it, but it is quite different. But you also have this tension. Especially, it's fascinating to see French people commentating, US politics. They say, "Oh, they're so casual. Have you seen the way they dress?" But on the other hand, there is so much money, you know, put into the political game that it's also shocking from the French people's point of view, but from the other perspective, in Japan and so on. Definitely.
Okay, I think we've got questions for as long as the organisers allow it, and the first organiser has put up his hand, so it must be allowed. Julian.
I'm really struck by all those fathers and mothers who are such an important part of the récit, and I know that. I don't talk about it. 1940, the decision to become a resistor is quite often described with a sort of reference to a father or encouragement or but how far back does this go? I was trying to think back to the young Trifouchard, and I mean, so you've got 1870, 1898, that's 28 years, and it's exactly the same period as 1940 to 1960. How many young Trifouchards are talking about exciting things that daddy did in 1870 or that daddy didn't do in 1870. I don't know. And so, therefore, I mean, is this récit about the very personal decision to become a modern revolutionary and the use of the father or the mother, is this really a late 20th century or mid-20th century thing?
Well, I can't. You'd need Ruth Harris here to answer the question about the Dreyfusards. And the thing about if you do a life history interview, you can actually, you know, you start with, you know, tell me about your family, and that's where you go to. And some of them do go back to, I mean, you know, Gesmar goes back to 1870, and Grunbach goes back to, they often, 1870 is quite often a starting point for their sort of family story. So I can answer that from the point of view of the 68 activists, but I'm afraid I can't answer that from the point of view of the Dreyfusards.
Thanks. Just two quick questions from somebody who's outside the field, but I found it fascinating. Sudhir, first of all, on the question of the non-military hero. And I wondered, is it not simply the fact that it's so difficult to define yourself as a military hero when you've got Pétain sat there, and the idea of swapping one military hero for another might actually not be the most, you know, sort of sensible political strategy, so possibly. And a question for Robert. I mean, you said at the beginning that you weren't going, quite rightly, I'm sure, to go into the details about the methodological issues of oral history. As somebody who works on the 18th century, I'd always wished I could, you know, sort of have a kind of a Doctor Who time machine and ask the questions. And the key question is what questions you ask, obviously. And just thinking about what we were listening to earlier on, the importance, obviously, the debates that Furrier was involved in, or indeed even when somebody like Alan was talking this morning about the Republican tradition and so on and so forth, did you ask your sample, you know, questions about their views on the revolutionary tradition? Because they could just as easily have talked about Babeuf or, you know, somebody like Jacques Roux or whoever. And just, you know, obviously the question is the answers you get will depend to some extent on the questions you ask.
I mean, the basic questions you ask are, you know, tell me about your family, tell me about your education, tell me about your first engagement with politics, tell me about 68, tell me about post 68, tell me about how it looks from now. So, and throughout, you're sort of trying to probe, particularly who they know and who they were involved with at the time. So that allows you to sort of set up networks. And I quite often ask them what they were reading, for example, when they were at school. And they do, some of them talk about the revolution. I mean, I suppose the most interesting interview I did was in that respect was with Romain Goupil, who was a trot, and, you know, the man who did Mourir à 30 ans, wonderful film about his dead friend. And he, one of the things that, you know, you get from him is that they went to classes, they went to sort of seminars run by people like, you know, slightly, he was born in 50 or 51. So there's, you know, Daniel Ben Saïd and Henri Weber used to have, they trained the sort of young trots, and then they, in the history of the labor movement and the history of the French Revolution. So one of the things he said is that, you know, I learned to say 71. When I said 71, everyone knew it meant 1871, not 1771 or 1671, whatever. So, they obviously had, you know, for some of them, a deep understanding of the labor movement, the revolutionary tradition. Whether it was more to do, whether that was more Trotskyist than Maoist, I'd have to think about. Probably my sample isn't big enough. But some of them are interested in that, and some of them have other references.
Thank you. Yes, I think part of the reason is to do with not wanting to kind of rekindle the kind of controversy about Vichy versus the Free French, and particularly the controversy over the figure of Pétain. But I think something just as important in terms of the Gaullian myth is that de Gaulle decides, and he does this very deliberately, I think, to create a kind of alternative narrative for what happened in France between 1940 and 1944. And that alternative narrative is basically two things. One is there was only one resistance. When the Gaullists write about the resistance, they say il y a eu plusieurs résistances, plural, mais il n'y a qu'une résistance. And the one resistance is the resistance movement that de Gaulle led. So the kind of concentration of it around the Free French is one very important part of the myth. And the second part of the myth is the idea, of course, that all the French people, or a large part of the French people, participated in the resistance. It wasn't only a Gaullist myth. Of course, the communists subscribed to it as well. And this is what Henri Rousseau calls the résistentialist idea, that, you know, if you add up these two myths, you get the impression that a large part of France was actively involved in resistance. So that was the, in a sense, sleight of hand that the Gaullian myth creates. It creates the notion, the idea that there is only one resistance, so the institutional divisions don't matter, and that most of the resistance activity was taking place within France and was therefore of a civilian nature. So that's why I think the Gaullian myth is non-military. And a quick further footnote is one of the consequences of this, and this comes out very well in a brilliant book that Jean-François Murassiol has just published on the Free French. One of the consequences of this is that a lot of the Free French combatants, right, the Free French soldiers who fought on various fronts, particularly in North Africa, but then also in 44-45 to liberate France and then to go into Germany, felt left out. They felt abandoned. They felt that de Gaulle himself didn't pay enough attention to, didn't give enough credit to the military contribution that they had made to free France.
Okay, I'm sorry. That I know that two more questions, but I've been told by the organisers that we have to stop because we start a bit late, and Bill Doyle's going to give us some concluding remarks, I think. So thank you very much to all the panellists for the session.